Welcome, everyone. This is the sixth lecture, the Mises Academy class, Mises on Money and Banking, where we go through the theory of money and credit. This is the inaugural version of the class, and we are in the first quarter of 2012. Again, I just like to time stamp it in case Ron Paul doesn't win the election and we end up with no society. Okay. Why don't we jump right into it? So tonight we're talking about monetary policy, and what you've all been waiting for, we're going to, near the end, get to the issue of inflation versus deflation. So for those of you who have been tuning in to the office hours, I've already talked about that a little bit, but this is the in terms of modern controversies and what kind of things are in the theory of money and credit. Let me just anticipate where I'm going to go with this. It's actually, I'm going to come down on saying that Salerno's case is stronger than I think even Salerno realizes. Okay, so anyway, but we'll talk about that. Okay, so when I say defined here on this first slide, I'm talking about monetary policy. Now, there is an issue for those who are extremely anal students. Let me just point this out. You'll notice, so the name of the chapter is monetary policy, but then, strictly speaking, like if you see in this particular quotation that I'm pulling here from page 216, Mises is talking about currency policy. And so you might wonder, well, is monetary policy and currency policy the same thing? So the problem is, remember, we're dealing here with a translation, right? So this Mises didn't write this in English. And if you go and look at this section here, and you look at the footnote from the editor, or the translator, I should say, he talks about, so there is a distinction. So in the German, Mises was using different phrases that the translator then is rendering either as monetary policy or currency policy. And don't tell anybody, but I really didn't get the distinction the translator was. He can list the German phrases and say Mises would say this and that. That means nothing to me because I don't speak German. So I'm just pointing that out. So for our purposes, for this class, certainly you don't need to worry about what's the distinction between monetary policy and currency policy. I'm just pointing out, strictly speaking, the translator is not using them interchangeably, and so they do mean so. In the German, Mises was writing different phrases for when you see it in the English in the translation we're using, monetary policy versus currency policy. And like I say, if you want to try to figure out what the distinction is, the editor or the translator does talk about that, I think, in the footnote on this to this passage that I've got here on the slide. Okay. But for our purposes, that's way too complex for what we need to know, so I want to go ahead and read this slide to you. This is a quote from Mises, page 216. Previously, good government in monetary matters consisted in conducting the business of minting so as to furnish commerce with coins which could be accepted by everybody at their face value. All right, so let me just stop there for a second. So what Mises is trying to get across here is monetary policy is going to have to do, I'm sorry, let me just finish the whole quote because I'm anticipating. All right, so that part, quote continues, when states did debase the coinage, it was always from purely fiscal motives. The government needed financial help, that was all. Questions of currency policy are questions of the objective exchange value of money. All right, so what Mises is getting at here, well, he's drawing this distinction between fiscal policy and monetary policy, what technically is being translated here as currency policy, and that distinction carries through to modern economics than policy analysis. All right, so even nowadays, people will distinguish between fiscal policy and monetary policy. So what is that distinction? And it's the same today as it was for Mises when he's writing The Theory of Money and Credit. Fiscal policy refers to the government and its budget. So the government levies taxes, or it might get revenues from other things like selling off assets, stuff like that. So the government takes in money and then it, and obviously spend a lot of money, spends it on the military, might give transfer payments to retirees, that sort of thing. All right, so that, so fiscal policy has to do with like the government running a deficit, raising taxes, spending, you know, having a spending cut. That's all fiscal policy. Whereas monetary policy has to do with, you know, nowadays that's what Ben Bernanke does, and that's, you know, oh gee, should the Fed try to change interest rates? Should the Fed try to increase the rate of price inflation? What should the Fed do? You know, should it increase the quantity of dollars? That kind of, so that's monetary policy. All right. So what Mises is saying here is historically, what it meant for the government to be doing its job in terms of monetary matters. So it came to, and I don't even know if they called it monetary policy. They probably didn't back then. As he was saying, it just meant they did a good job of giving merchants and the public coins that were trustworthy, right? So remember, I don't know if I've stressed this before in this class, or at least in the lectures. I'm sure it's come up in the study guide. Even constitutionally, in terms of the United States, and I'm not as familiar with other governments' constitutions or you know, legal precedents and so forth, but certainly in the United States, originally, when the Constitution is talking about coinage and things like that and the role of the federal government in regulating money, it's only in the government's capacity as the sort of body that has the authority or the responsibility to define weights and measures, right? So just like if you're going to have the government running a legal system, and obviously most, you know, even Mises himself was not an anarcho-capitalist, right? So everybody in these classical liberal circles takes it for granted that the court system and the police power are going to be in the hands of the government. So given that, and given that ultimately if people are disagreeing over the terms of a contract, right, they sign a contract, one party says, hey, you didn't fulfill the terms of this contract, the other guy says, yes, I did. What are you talking about? I said I would deliver to you 8 bushels of wheat, and I did. And the other guy says, no, that's not a real bushel. A bushel means such and such. And you only gave me, you know, 0.7 bushels. It's not one bushel. If they're having an argument over that, like the term, like what is the definition in the contract, then, and you take it to a judge, obviously there has to be some legally acceptable definition of what does bushel mean. You see how that works? So it's, even if they're agreeing on the, you know, they're stipulating the physical facts of the case, what if they had different definitions of what that word bushel meant? So there's that kind of stuff. And then, as Mises has already talked about in the theory of money and credit, when it comes to financial liabilities or you know, things that you owe to somebody else, there are issues, you know, let's say you owe somebody $2,000 or if you're, you know, you're 2,000 euros, whatever. Do you have to actually pay them in the notes nowadays, or does it work? Can you write them a personal check, or would it work to get them a money order from the post office, or you know, a draft from a reputable bank? You see the point that it's to say if you sign a contract with someone and it says I owe you $2,000, it's you know, or what if I show up with a bunch of pennies? Does that satisfy you? You see the point there that it's, but also what if I show up with a laptop and I say, here you go, this thing is worth $2,000. So you can see how if stuff like that goes to court, the government has to ultimately decide on these definitions, right? Or if somebody, you know, and even things like 12 inches are in a foot, technically the legal system has to recognize that. And so when it comes to the money and things like, at least in the U.S. Constitution, giving Congress the authority to coin money, that did not at all mean that they could create a Federal Reserve that then could issue fiat dollars. That's not at all what they meant. They meant that they could, you know, legally define what people mean by the dollar in terms of this is the anchor, this is the definition of the dollar in terms of, you know, grains of silver or whatever. And that's, so it was more like just saying, okay, so everybody is using the word dollar to mean the same thing. This is what a dollar is defined as. It's this much physical silver. Just like, you know, so we're all on the same page. When we, if some contracts refer to a foot, that's the same thing as 12 inches. If other contracts refer to inches, okay, so that's how those units work. You see the idea there? Okay. So Mises is saying, in that context then, what it used to mean historically for a government to be doing a good job with respect to its responsibilities vis-a-vis money was that it provided the people in the country with coins that were hard to counterfeit and that you couldn't clip the edges off of, and that it was, so people didn't need to spend a lot of time. So if somebody shows up at the store and something costs, whatever, 2 ounces of gold, and they pull out a bunch of coins, each coin purporting to be 1/10 of an ounce, and they try to pay with 20 of them, right, that the merchant doesn't have to, like, go to his back room and come out with, like, a chemical test and test each coin and then weigh it and make sure that it's not underweight and put, you know, submerge it and make sure the density. You see what I'm saying? That these things, you should just be able to inspect them in a moment's glance and say, oh, yeah, that's a legitimate 1/10 ounce gold coin that is issued by the state mint. And, you know, the state mint uses the proper procedures and whatever to ensure that these things are really hard to counterfeit, and that once they're in circulation, these legitimate things, it's hard to debase them or to any other way sort of clip the edges or get the gold content out. Okay, so there's techniques for the proper maintenance of the coinage. So that's what historically it meant for the state to be doing its job in that respect. Meaning, in case you're wondering, like, well, what else could it mean? The point is, their job was not to ensure full employment by inflating the money supply, or, oh, gee, if prices are rising too much, well, then we better, as good state managers of money, we better tighten. Right? Whereas nowadays, that is what people think of when they say, you know, what would it mean for the government to be doing a good job with respect to managing the money supply? They don't mean providing people with trustworthy physical things so that people know they're not being literally defrauded in a given transaction. No, nowadays, people think it means, like, you know, keeping inflation under control, by which they mean price inflation. Or, you know, Krugman and those guys can't stand the European Central Bank because they think, oh my gosh, you guys aren't providing enough stimulus or liquidity or whatever you want to call it for the situation over there. You guys are starving for more, for promised future inflation. And so why don't you go ahead and give them that? Why are you being so stingy? You guys are doing a very bad job. You're pushing the continent to the verge of another depression with your terrible mismanagement of the money supply. Krugman doesn't mean, oh, it's really easy for me to go into a Kinko's and counterfeit a euro note. The ECB is doing a bad job over there. Okay, so I'm belaboring this, but I really want to make sure you guys get the point. This is a fundamental transformation in what people conceived of as the proper duty and responsibility of the government when it came to money. Okay. And then also, last thing here before we move on, Mises is saying, even, you know, back in the day, before this modern meaning, when Mises is writing there in early 1900s, that modern conception of monetary policy, back in the day, even when the state did a bad job and they didn't provide, you know, solid commodity currency where the coins were full weight gold or silver and that sort of thing, and people could really trust them and the prices wouldn't rise because of that fact. Mises thing, even when they did deviate from that norm or that ideal, it wasn't because they were trying to help the farmers, right? It wasn't that they were trying to eradicate the debts And so they inflated to try to, you know, wipe away those past decisions and start from scratch. The way a lot of people now are calling for more inflation is a way to ease the debt burden, whether for the government or in the United States. You know, people are calling for that because of homeowners who are underwater and stuff. And so a lot of people are saying Bernanke ought to inflate more to get the price inflation rate up higher, and that will help reduce the real burden of like these mortgages that people are carrying with their homes being underwater and stuff like that, right? So they have very specific distributional goals in mind, and they think monetary policy is the way to accomplish them. So Mises is saying, even, you know, this is new. Back in the day, even when a government would inflate, it wasn't trying to achieve some ultimate economic distributional objective. It was just, you know, there was a war going on and the king knew, I can't raise taxes anymore, there's going to be a revolt, I can't borrow any more money, the nobles already are saying that I'm, you know, my credit with them is all tapped out, what do? I really want to spend a bunch more money. I know when I collect the taxes and the coins, I'll melt the coins down and add in some baser metal and then recoin them, and I'll have more coins, and I'll be able to spend them, and it'll take a while for the community to catch on that I've debased the coins. Right? So you see, they're engaging in inflation, and you still have all the economic consequences of it, but the motive was just the king needed to spend more money, and that was the only thing that would work. It wasn't that they were, you know, deliberately trying to raise prices or to help debtors and hurt creditors or to help the gold miners or whatever. Okay. Types of money in state discretion. So let me read this quote and then we'll talk about it. Mises says, if a country has a metallic standard, then the only measure of currency policy that can carry out by itself is to go over to another kind of money. It is otherwise with credit money and fiat money. Here the state is able to influence the movement of the objective exchange value of money by increasing or decreasing its quantity. The means is extremely crude, and the extent of its consequences can never be foreseen, but it is easy to apply and popular. All right, so those two question marks in brackets, I put those in there early in this, you know, after that first sentence, because I'm not myself sure what Mises means by that, and I have a question out to a group of Austrian economists, and I'm still waiting to hear. I'm hoping Guido Holzmann can chime in, or maybe Salerno, and tell me what they think. But hang on, let me just check real fast and see if they've answered. Okay. Yeah, I'm glad I checked the Salerno didn't answer. Okay, so let me explain the issue, and then I'll tell you what Joe Salerno said. Okay, so the issue is, and why I was putting the question marks, is it what Mises seems to be saying here is that if a country is on, let's say, the gold standard or the silver standard, that's what he means by metallic standard, in case that's not obvious. He means that the money is a metal. It's a commodity. So Mises is saying, once if a government decides, for example, okay, for our monetary policy, we're going to just tie our money to gold at a fixed exchange rate, then he's saying at that point, the only other, you know, the only decision for you to make is if you decide to go over to another kind of money, right? That it's not like you can be on the gold standard and then separately decide, okay, what do we want interest rates to be? Do we want to, you know, what do we want, what's our target for price inflation? Do we want to target 5% price inflation per year or 3%? No, if you decide we're on the gold standard, that's it. I mean, I guess you got to decide how many dollars per ounce of gold, but the point is once you pick that thing, boom, that's it. And then the only issue is, are we going to stick to this or are we going to abandon the gold standard and do something else? That's what Mises is claiming there. He's saying, whereas if you're on credit money or fiat money, then you have this the secondary decision or freedom to say, okay, we have fiat money, and now what do we want to do with the money supply? What do we want to do with the purchasing power of money? Do we want it to go up or to go down? Because you have that freedom to do that. So the reason I have the question marks there is I was saying, wait a minute, but during World War I, for example, the United States clearly used monetary policy to fund the war effort. So if you go and look at like the Fed's balance sheet, or just what you can do is go to the Fed website if you're curious, and go look up the monetary base and just look at it from, you know, when the Fed starts in 19. I'm trying to think. I don't think the figures actually go back that far, but you can see that it goes way up, and then it crashes after like 1920, 21. All right, so clearly the Fed inflated, and then also if you go look at the price, you know, the consumer price index, annual price inflation rates were above 15% in, you know, 1919, 1920, around there, and that's why the Fed had to really jack up interest rates and crash the base. But the U.S. was technically on the gold standard still, whereas the other belligerents went up. So that was, okay, so that's one thing that it looked like, even though the U.S. was not technically on the gold standard, right, $20.67 to an ounce of gold, that it seemed like it was able for the Fed to, you know, monkey with the quantity of dollars and change prices. And then through the 20s, of course, what's the standard Austrian explanation for the boom that developed, then crashed in 29 and led to the Great Depression? Is they say, oh, well, the Fed was inflating. And yet, as we all should know, the U.S. was technically on the gold standard up until 1933, when FDR took us off. So that's why I put those question marks, that the standard Austrian story says that the Fed, you know, that there was a dark day in U.S. history with the establishment of the Federal Reserve in late 1913, because look at all the bad stuff the Fed did. It was able to fund the, you know, U.S. entry into World War I. We never would have participated nearly as much, with all the dire consequences, if it weren't for the central bank. And, you know, people will say that's partly why they pushed through the central bank, was to be able to have the U.S. become a world empire. And then, of course, you know, standard Austrian view is that the 1920s bubble was caused by the Fed. And yet throughout that whole period, we were on the gold standard. So what I asked the list was, is Mises just making a relative argument here that, well, yeah, sure, you're a gold standard doesn't completely tie your hands, but it does, you know, keep a lot more limit on what you can do compared to credit money or fiat money, where there's, you know, the link to the precious metal has been suspended. So anyway, I just checked, and Salerno said that he thinks Mises is saying something stronger. He thinks what Mises has in mind here is an open economy in the days of the classical gold standard, where, you know, there's a bunch of countries and they're all on the gold standard. And so if any one of them deviates, if any one of them starts inflating, then it is quickly going to have its gold reserves flow out. All right, and the mechanism for that, let me just talk about it real quickly. I think I read it in this class, but I don't remember if I did it during on office hours session or if I did it during the actual live lecture, but in my Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, I walk through a specific numerical example of this. But the idea is, you know, there's the official exchange rates. So the U.S. would be $20.67 per ounce of gold, and I think the British pound, I think it was 4.25 pounds per ounce of gold. And so that would, you know, if you just run through the numbers, you can see the sort of natural anchor price of, I think it was like $4.86 for a British pound, just, you know, by multiplying through and or dividing through and seeing what. But that wasn't like a price control. I mean, it could deviate in practice in the foreign exchange markets. So if the Federal Reserve started inflating more, or let's say even before there was a Fed, you know, in the year 1911, if if the U.S. government allowed the creation of more dollars, then that would, other things equal, you know, that would mean on the foreign exchange markets that the dollar price of a pound would go up. So maybe it would go up to, you know, 490, 491, 492, right? Because there's more dollars now chasing British pounds. And so then, but so long as the U.S. government remained committed to exchanging gold at fixed dollar ratio and the British, you know, the Bank of England was doing the same thing, they would set up an arbitrage opportunity, right? So there'd be a little band where it wouldn't make sense, but once it got past what would be called the gold export point, then it would make sense, you know, depending on the numbers and which way it's going, that people would, they would take dollars and turn it in to the U.S. government and get gold, and then take the gold and present it to the Bank of England and get, so what you do, if you were a British merchant, let's say, or a British speculator, and the dollar is getting pushed up, right, so it's 490, 491, 492, when normally it's like 486, then you would take your pounds, turn them into dollars on the foreign exchange market, take the dollars, go to the U.S. government, turn it in for gold at the locked rate, take the gold, you know, ship it across the ocean, turn it into the Bank of England, and then get your pounds back. And so if you, you know, you would end up with more pounds than you started out with at the point. So there would be a riskless trade. So you wouldn't do it if there's just a 1 cent difference. But I mean, in that gap from where the anchor price was gets bigger and bigger because there are more dollars being created than British pounds. The point is eventually you're going to get that flow of gold out of the United States and over to England if the authorities allow dollars to grow faster than the British authorities allow the pounds to grow. So what Joe Salerno was saying is, imagine that. So now you got that system in place. I just described it as from the perspective of those two countries, but now there's dozens of countries that all tie their currencies to gold in that strict fashion. And so you can see how that would keep everybody honest. And they really couldn't inflate. Because if you inflated, then you're presumably inflating faster than somebody, and then your gold's going to flow to that country. Okay, so that's what Joe was saying. And then he said the reason that broke down during World War One, that yes, I'm correct that the U.S. was able to inflate significantly despite technically being still on the gold standard through World War One, is because all the other belligerents just totally stopped redeeming their stuff in gold. Right, so if only one country stays on the gold standard, that's not nearly as much of a constraint as if they're all still on the gold standard. And then he said in the 20s and early 30s, it never really went back to the original classical gold standard. And we don't have time to get into it in this course. If you have my politically incorrect guidebook, you can see some of that. And Rothbard talks about it, and that's, I have a little quote from him. But during the 20s, there was – so let me put it this way. When people say – this is very typical among Keynesians and also – market monetarists, guys like Scott Sumner, they will say, oh yeah, the gold standard totally blew up in the world's face in the early 30s. And they'll, you know, have little diagrams showing that countries that abandoned the gold standard, their recovery started right, you know, if you arrange countries in terms of when did they finally go off gold in the 30s, it looks like, oh, and that's when their recovery started. So like the countries that were the most stubborn and clung to the gold standard were the ones that had the most delayed recovery from the Great Depression, that kind of stuff. And that's, there's specific problems with that argument anyway, but even the initial premise is wrong. That what they had by the 1930s was not the classical gold standard. It was at best a gold exchange standard where Great Britain and the U.S. were sort of like the, you know, the anchors. Okay. But, So anyway, what Mises is saying in this quotation, though, is that you really, if a government is committed to the classical gold standard, and that's the system we're envisioning, and that's of course the ideal system from Mises' point of view, then that's really the only decision to make. After you do that, everything else just gets subordinated to that goal of maintaining that defined exchange rate between your currency and gold or silver, whatever the metal is. It's, in other words, you can on top of that then say, oh, and what's our goal for price inflation? Do we want it to be between 1 and 2%? You can't do that because the point is it's just going to be whatever it's going to be given your need to maintain. So if gold starts flowing out of your treasury or your vaults, whatever, your stockpile, your reserves, you have to stop printing as much money. And then if gold starts flowing in, I mean, I guess you could get away with letting your gold reserves build up, but clearly you can't get away with them flowing out. And if your gold reserves are building up, that means some other government's reserves are going down, and presumably they're going to tighten until they start flowing out of your thing back. Okay, slide 3, types of inflationists. So first Mises talks about the naive inflationists. So here he means people who think, you know, who are so simplistic that they actually believe, well, gee, why doesn't the government just create more money and then we'll all be rich, right? That if I'm updating it to modern terminology, I mean, if I just, somebody gives me $1 million, if I have $1 million more than I had yesterday, clearly I'm wealthier. I you know, that changes my life. So why shouldn't the authorities just give everybody an extra $1 million? And they think it's, you know, some big conspiracy on the part of the bankers or something to keep all the money to themselves because they want to be rich and everyone else be poor. Right, so that's the extreme naive inflationist who just thinks, you know, who doesn't understand that there's real scarcity. They just think the way to solve all the world's economic problems is just to print money. All right, so then Mises says, okay, that's, you know, we don't really need to deal seriously with those people because they're so naive. He said, but there are other people now, they're not as naive as that. They understand full well that the reason, or if you just started printing up millions of dollars and handing them out to various people, that that would cause prices to go up, that it would reduce the purchasing power of the dollar. But Mises says, the second class of inflationists, they understand that and they welcome it. They want there to be depreciation. Whereas in contrast, the naive inflationists, they don't even get that. They don't understand that if you just keep printing money, then, you know, that $1 million isn't going to buy as much if you gave it to everybody. Whereas the second group of people, yeah, they understand that and they want it to happen. For example, maybe they think that farmers have too heavy of a debt burden right now. You know, they mortgage their farms to the bank in order to buy seed, and prices weren't what they thought they were going to be, and so now, you know, they're all in danger of losing their farms in foreclosure. And if we could just come in and kind of double all of the prices of goods and services, that would really help the farmers because their interest payments to the bank, you know, their payments to the bank, and the interest and then the principal on, you know, if they took out a 15-year mortgage or whatever they took out, that's going to stay contractually the same because it was a fixed rate mortgage. And so then if wheat prices and cotton prices and tomatoes all double, then the farmers are, you know, and so their input prices will double too. You know, they'll have to pay more for feed and stuff like that. But the point is, whatever meager net income they were making will double, other things equal. And so that will allow them to make those fixed payments to the bank more easily. So that's why that group of people might welcome a depreciation, would want inflation, knowing full well it will reduce the purchasing power of the currency. Okay, and then Mises says, now there's an even more sophisticated type of inflationist. This person not only understands that printing money will lead to a depreciation in its purchasing power, this person also recognizes the harmful effects of that. You know, they understand that that's really not a good policy to do, that it has serious downsides, that you can't just, every time that the farmers get indebted, you can't just inflate it away because now the creditors are going to be very reluctant to lend, and that might, you know, freeze up credit markets, and then people will have to maybe, you know, engage in shorter term planning, because now business people aren't sure what the purchasing power of the currency is going to be, so everybody's making only 2-year plans, and they're they're doing things like investing in hedges, so they're putting a lot of their effort into protecting themselves from a possible depreciation instead of focusing on their customers, that sort of stuff. So, right, so this group, this third group, understands the downside of sort of periodic bouts of depreciation caused by creating more money. But he said this third group of inflationists, even though they understand what the consequences, nonetheless, they welcome the inflation in cases where they're saying it's just the only way where the government is going to be able to engage in these expenditures that are absolutely critical. So the classic example would be if there's a war. So these people would say, yeah, you know, we understand you economists. You told us the danger of running the printing press. We know it's going to, you know, mess things up. It's going to interfere with economic coordination. It's going to make it harder to plan things going forward, blah, blah, blah. But you know what? It doesn't matter. If the government doesn't raise another, 50% of its current budget and spend it on tanks and machine guns, we're going to be taken over by a hostile country. So whatever consequences you're talking about from the inflation economically pale in comparison to us being literally conquered. And the population right now is not going to go for a tax increase. And foreign lenders aren't going to lend us any more money. Our own domestic capitalists are mortgaged already to the hilt. So the only way we're going to be able to have the government afford these munitions is if we turn to the printing press, knowing that what we're doing. So Mises has a very interesting little discussion on that, saying it's very anti-democratic with a small d, and that in fact it just shows a complete disregard for the will of the people, in the sense that, think about what that sort of inflationist is saying. He's saying the people are too stupid. That if we try to just, the government needs to spend this money to buy enough tanks and machine guns and whatever. And if we just told the public we have to raise your taxes to fend off this foreign aggressor, by stipulation, you're saying the public would say, no, we're not paying those taxes, that's too much. And so the inflationist then says, okay, well, I don't respect your decision. We're going to still make you pay for it, but the way we're going to take that wealth out of your hands and devote and divert it into the war effort is through inflation, something you don't have control over. Because the thing you do have control over, paying taxes, I realize you're not going to go for that. Right? So Mises' point there is, say what you will about that, but it is the mark of an autocrat, a dictator, somebody who thinks he should be able to thwart the desires of everybody else and take the government in a direction that he thinks is more important than what other people believe. And that's why Mises is saying it's not a coincidence then that the socialists and others, budding totalitarians are attracted to inflation, because they see this is it's a great tool to have at our disposal, that we can very easily take control of society's scarce resources if we have control of the printing press. And we don't have to get permission from everybody else and ask them for loans or, have taxes where they're all pretty, the public isn't stupid. They can they know if they're getting taxed and they're paying higher taxes, they know that we're taking it from them. So the printing press allows us to basically fleece them without them really knowing what's causing it. Because the public, if prices are just rising, and so that's how the public is impoverished, while their incomes don't go up as quickly, they're going to blame the greedy capitalists, or they'll blame the labor unions, or they'll blame speculators. They're not going to blame us for running the printing press, or at least it's not going to be as obvious as if we just explicitly raise their taxes, where they can see that we're explicitly borrowing all this money and interest rates are through the roof. Okay. Slide 4, pace of hyperinflation. This was an interesting point Mises made. I just wanted to touch on. on page 227, he says, in all countries where inflation has been rapid, it has been observed that the decrease in the value of the money has occurred faster than the increase in its quantity. All right, so notice, by the way, that I'm the one who put the word hyperinflation there. Mises is just saying more generally in countries where inflation has been rapid. So obviously that would include the great hyperinflations we know of, but I mean, he means a more general thing. So what is he saying? He's saying it's not, the point he was making in this context is you want to get away from a mechanical conception of the quantity theory of money, that you don't want to walk around thinking, oh, if the quantity of money doubles, then its purchasing power gets cut in half. I mean, you could say that's true other things equal, but the point is other things won't be equal, especially if you're engaging in large increases in the quantity of money, that act by itself will make people not want to hold the currency as much, will reduce the demand to hold it, right? I mean, so this, let me just talk about that for a second. It sort of makes sense to say, or it's more defensible to say, other things equal, if the supply of apples doubles, the price of apples will get cut in half. Right? You could sort of, I mean, that's not a bad way to start thinking about, let's say. I mean, certainly speaking, you probably should say supply of apples doubles, then the price of an apple goes down and the quantity goes up. I would feel more comfortable just saying that rather than saying it's cut in half, but okay. But part of that is because, you know, having more apples doesn't reduce the desire of any individual apple per se. You know, it doesn't, you know, decrease what the apple is good for. So of course, if you have more of them, you're devoting them to less and less important ends. But the point is, the quantity of the apples and the fact that they increased, that by itself wouldn't obviously change your demand for apples, if you see what I'm saying. But on the other hand, your demand to hold money is partly based on your expectations of its future purchasing power and the fact that it's going to be, for lack of a better term, a store of value. And so if you're in the extreme case, if you don't know if the, you know, you're using a currency and you're not sure, it's possible that 1 month from now the monetary authority is going to increase the quantity of that currency by a factor of 1 quadrillion, and you're not sure if they're going to, they might do that, they might not, they're going to flip a coin. And if it comes up heads, they're going to keep the currency where it is, you know, the quantity. If it comes up tails, they're going to go buy so many assets, they're going to try to buy the entire stock markets of every country in the world by just creating money, just writing checks. And that's what they're going to do if it comes up tails and they flip that coin. Well, are you going to want to hold that currency right now? No, you're going to want to get out of that. You're going to spend it on anything, because that is such a volatile asset now for you to be holding. All right, so the point is, it's particularly misleading or not helpful to say other things equal, if the supply of money goes way up, then it will lead to a proportional drop in its value. Because again, it's the very fact of increasing the supply that would change your demand. Whereas with other commodities, that's not as obviously the case as it is with money. Okay, and what Mises is saying is that empirically we do see that. So the point is, once a country starts down the road of rapidly escalating price inflation, right, once once a country's currency starts depreciating at a faster and faster rate, it eventually snowballs, and it happens even more than the increase in the quantity of money. So it's not a proportional thing. And you see that, like, in the German hyperinflation, and in Zimbabwe, it was the same way. And in the limit, if you just think about it, what if a currency just ultimately collapses so that people no longer use it, it ceases to be money? Well, then obviously that claim has to be true, right? Because the only way to make the price literally go to zero, the purchasing power of the currency go to zero, if you adhered to a, you know, proportionality view, would be if they created an infinite number of units of it. And obviously they can't do that. No matter how much they create, there's still only a finite amount of it. So the point is, clearly, if you get to the point, if they run the printing presses so much that people just decide to abandon the currency altogether and switch to either barter or switch to some other currency from another issuer, that first currency, its value dropped by more than its quantity went up in terms of percentages or whatever. Okay. The whole point of that was, when it comes to the value of money, supply and demand matter. You can't just focus on supply. Okay. Slide 5, deflationism. All right, Mises says it is unpopular except possibly after there's been a bout of inflation. So the only time that you can generally get the public worked up and demanding conscious efforts to restrict the quantity of money in order to drive up its purchasing power is if the public just went through a bout of inflationism and a drop in its purchasing power, and they kind of want to undo that. But he said, just generally speaking, it's not like the public out of the blue is going to say, hey, can you contract the money stock and raise its purchasing power? That's not a popular thing to ask for. All right, and then on 234, Mises says, to carry out a deflationary policy is not to do away with the consequences of inflation. You cannot make good an old breach of the law by committing a new one. And as far as debtors are concerned, restriction is a breach of the law. All right, so Mises comes back to this theme again and again throughout the book, and then even in the later essays that, you know, that were added afterwards, after the first edition. So, and I don't know if he says it in this book, but he says it, I think, in Human Action. He used the analogy to say, if you run over somebody, you don't make up for it by then putting the car in reverse and then backing up over the person, right? You're hurting them coming and then going. So he says it's the same kind of thing. If a government has been irresponsible and has inflated, and then, you know, in so doing, it hurt the creditors and helped the debtors, and then also, you know, caused the boom bust cycle and other bad things. Some people think, oh, well, let's undo that. So now let's deflate. Let's pull some of the currency out of circulation and destroy it, raise the purchasing power of the currency, and thereby help creditors and hurt debtors. And so we'll at least try to partially offset, you know, the distributional things that the inflation caused. And Mises is saying, no, that's, he doesn't say in this particular quote, but this is what he's getting at, that's not true. He says you can't undo it, for one thing, just because they're not the same people. And he, like I said, he goes through examples of this in several places in the book, that the only way that might make sense is if you thought it was literally the same people, you know, that there were debtors and creditors, and then there was an inflation, and they kept their contracts and their bonds or whatever, and they're still making the interest payments, and then, sure, you rolled it back and did it the other way. But he said in the real world, that's not what happens, that there are plenty of, for example, so let's say there was a big inflation over a 10-year period, and now the public, you know, is knocking on its back and realizes, oh, my gosh, we just really ripped off all the creditors, and basically gave a gift to all the debtors. And they're debating that for a couple of years. And you know what? Let's take a 10-year period and deflate back to the original parity of the currency 25 years ago. Well, if there were new debtors and creditors who entered into credit arrangements in years 8 through 14 or whatever, in that span, well, those are completely new people, and then you're going to just hurt the one group and help the other group with this new policy of deflation. So it's not that you're just undoing the effects of the original one. So that's what Mises is getting at. I should point out that not all Austrians are in agreement with Mises on this. I mean, they all agree with the technical economic point, but I think Rothbard, for example, was a lot more sympathetic to the British government's efforts to bring the pound back to the pre-war parity. So the classic historical example of this idea that Mises and Hayek were both against is that the British government inflated during World War I. You know, they officially suspended redemption of the pound, and so at that point it was credit money in the Misesian system because they weren't forever renouncing the pound's tie to gold. They were just saying we can't do it right now because we got a world war going on here. And then in the 20s, the British government, if they could have just gone back to tied the pound back to gold now and just acknowledged the fact that, okay, we inflated, and so instead of it being 4.25 pounds per ounce, now it's going to be whatever, 5.5. I don't remember what I've seen figures on what the actual market exchange rates were, and I can't remember. But they didn't want that. They wanted they were saying, like, no, you know, the British government is good for its commitments. You know, we have to assure the world markets that London is the center of world commerce, that you want to have assets denominated in pounds, that, you know, sterling is solid, blah, blah, blah. And so we're going to, you know, they didn't do it on a dime. It took them several years, but they wanted to gradually deflate back to their pre-war parity so that the British pound, for example, exchanged against the dollar at the same ratio. Because if they just acknowledged the war inflation and just said, well, that's a done deal, let's just accept that what we did, well, then going forward, the British pound would be weaker against the U.S. dollar than it had been in 1913. And so they didn't want that. They wanted the British pound to trade against the dollar at the old pre-war parity. So Hayek and Mises thought that was a terrible mistake, that it caused a wrenching adjustment process where, so labor unions were strong in Great Britain, and so that meant in order to lower prices, the workers all had to take nominal wage cuts, otherwise businesses couldn't stay profitable. And so it just caused wrenching problems. Since labor unions were strong, they resisted the wage cuts, and that led to massive unemployment, right? Because the government's there trying to strengthen the purchasing power of the British pound, and labor unions don't want workers' nominal paychecks to go down, so that's a recipe for disaster. And so and that was part of the issue, and that's partly why the heads of the Bank of England, the Bank of France, and Benjamin Strong from the Federal Reserve, they all got together in the 20s and decided, okay, we're going to take pressure off the pound. The U.S., the Federal Reserve is going to inflate, right? Because remember, what needed to happen is the British pound needed to strengthen against the dollar. So they were saying, okay, we can't let the British have to just absorb all that pain. So we can help them by weakening the dollar from our end, by printing more dollars. And that was partly what led the U.S. to do what it did in the mid-20s, and that's, in my opinion, what got the stock market bubble going. Okay, but anyway, that's what's going on. That's the context of this quote. Last point there is Joe Salerno one time mentioned in the lecture that Rothbard – I don't know if Rothbard approved of the project from the outset, but the point is, like, by the late 20s, the British government was almost there. Like, they, you know, they had endured a bunch of, you know, painful years of what we would now call austerity or, you know, deflation, whatever, to try to get back to this thing. And so Salerno said that Rothbard, I don't remember the exact quote, but that he kind of felt, well, since you're almost there, you might as well go for it and go ahead and get the thing back. And I kind of, you know, there could be an argument that going forward, it is more reassuring to investors that even if you, you know, even if you thought there was going to be a temporary deviation from the currencies tied to the precious metals, eventually they're going to restore it. So, yeah, you might, if you have bonds or something denominated in that currency, yeah, if you needed to cash them in right when a major war is going on, you might get ripped off in a sense. But if you can just sit on them, eventually they're going to restore the value of the currency so that you're getting paid back in money units that have the purchasing power that you thought when you originally signed on to it. Okay. Stable money, slide 6. Mises says, for most people, so far as they do not incline to inflationistic ideas, that money seems to be the best whose objective exchange value is not subject to any variation at all, whether originating on the monetary side or on the commodity side, end quote. Okay, so let me just, first of all, make sure you understand that distinction that I put in italics there. So So the objective exchange value of money, what does that mean? It says you got the money good, let's say it's a commodity like gold, what is the objective exchange value of an ounce of gold in the marketplace? So that's an objective number. We're not talking about in people's minds how do they value gold against other things. No, we're talking about you just go look at the actual prices. And I realize if I have an ounce of gold, I can trade it for whatever, 100 hours of labor, of unskilled labor. Or I can trade it for 6 visits to a chiropractor. I can trade it for 1/10 of a horse. Or, you know, I'm just making up these numbers. Okay, so those are objective prices, and that's the objective exchange value of money. So if that changes now, well, there's 2 possible sources of that change. So let's say that originally, you know, last year, 1 ounce of gold would trade for 1/10 of a house, you know, certain, you know, 3-bedroom house in a certain neighborhood. We can specify what we mean by a house. And 1 ounce of gold would trade for 1/10 of that. And now this year, 1 ounce of gold trades for 1 house. So that's interesting. Okay, so the objective exchange value of that ounce of gold in terms of houses went way up. Before, you needed 10 ounces of gold to buy the 1 house. This year, you only need 1 ounce of gold to buy the house. So now the question is, what really happened there? Is it that the gold got more valuable, or is it the houses got less valuable? You see how that works? And so, in, you know, so one way you might try to isolate that is to say, well, wait a minute, look at other prices. If everything quoted in gold ounces dropped by a factor of 10, then we're going to say, oh, it's that the gold got more valuable. Whereas if everything else went up in gold prices and for some reason just houses dropped by 90% or whatever, then you might say, oh, well, for some reason, like there's a glut of houses or whatever, there's a outbreak of some sort of disease and all the population died, and so now there's no one left to buy houses anymore. Whatever, you get the point. So so that's what Mises is getting at. So I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think you will find that what Mises – so first of all, this notion, this idea, this alleged ideal money of having a constant objective exchange value that doesn't change whether coming from the monetary or the commodity side. Mises thinks that's actually not a good money. That first of all, it's inconceivable, it's impossible, but that if you really understood what you're saying, you wouldn't want that to happen. That you, if there are, you do want the gold house exchange ratio to be flexible, because there, you know, people's, put it this way, if the gold versus good or service exchange ratio is going to be fixed for every single good and service, well, then that in turn implies that the relative prices of all those things in terms of each other is also fixed. All right, so if the gold price of a house can't move and the gold price of a car can't move, well, then that means the relative exchange value of houses versus cars also can't move. And so the point is, that's not good. The prices are supposed to convey relative scarcity and help people adjust, help, you know, producers make more of the things that are profitable and cut back on the things that are unprofitable, make resources flow to where they're needed the most, that kind of stuff. You need constantly changing prices to guide you in those decisions. And so you clearly don't want a money that has a fixed exchange value vis-a-vis every single good. But what you might want, and I think this is much closer to what Mises has in mind in terms of an ideal monetary system, is where if there are variations, they're coming from the commodity side. So if the money price of houses changes, it's because there are real changes in people's supply and demand for houses, per se. Now, I don't read too much in. Well, here, let me go ahead and read this next slide. It ties into it. Okay, so the next slide, case for metallic money. The significance of adherence to a metallic money system lies in the freedom of the value of money from state influence that such a system guarantees. Right, so that kind of ties into that previous quote where Mises is saying, you know, once a government decides that we're going to go on a metallic standard where we're tying our currency to a fixed weight of some metal, such as gold or silver, that's it. There's no more decisions to make, because then it's just, you know, they have to watch their reserves of that precious metal to make sure they don't run out. And you know, they've tied their hands at that point. Okay. But now Mises says, but there is a downside to that. So he says, even though, quote, considerable disadvantages are involved in the fact that fluctuations in the conditions of production of the metal and variations in the industrial demand for it exert an influence on the determination of the value of money. All right, so what is he talking about? Here Mises is saying, look, so why would Mises say it's a great idea for a government to link its currency to gold? When he's saying now the value of money is no more a political decision. We don't have to worry about a Ben Bernanke or somebody sitting around thinking, huh, should I try to increase the money supply? That's not his decision. Because if it's locked in, and especially in the context if there's plenty of other participating countries and they've all locked their currencies into gold at a fixed ratio, all you do is watch the stockpile of gold in your vaults, and if it starts dropping, you have to tighten. And if it's rapidly accumulating, I guess you could print more if you wanted to. But again, other countries would react, and you probably wouldn't see that situation persist where you're constantly accumulating gold in the vault. Okay. So so now you're doing that, and that takes it completely out of the political realm. But that doesn't guarantee that the value of money is now being determined solely by changes on the commodity side. Right, so even now, let's say you've tied your currency to gold, and now we've said, okay, you don't have to worry about the politicians and the technocrats affecting gold prices, because they can't. That's not in their power anymore, given that they're rigidly adhering to a classical gold standard. But you shouldn't conclude from that that therefore, if you see the gold price of something, you know, you see the if a house's quoted gold price changes, you can't just conclude, oh, it must be that the supply of or the demand for housing relative to other goods must have changed. Well, no, because it could be that there was a new discovery of gold in South Africa. And now there's tons of new gold being mined and dumped on the market. And so that makes the relative exchange value of gold compared to everything else go down. And so you would see the price of the same house quoted in gold ounces now going up, because now there's just more gold in people's possession. Not because the government did anything, it's still on the gold standard, but because there was a mining operation. Or if all of a sudden there's this new discovery and people realize that, oh, if we use gold, we can treat arthritis with it. They didn't realize that. So now there's massive quantities of gold that are being taken out of this use as money and injected into people, and their bodies absorb it, and it's, let's say you can't extract it from dead people. I don't really know the chemistry involved, but I know you use gold in arthritis treatments. So assume they use a ton of it, or more than tons. All right, what would that do? Well, that would make other things equal, the price of a house quoted in gold go down. Not because there's anything going on with housing, but because a lot of the gold that was being used as money before is now being siphoned off and being diverted to this other application, this medical application. Because again, the gold is a commodity. It's also money, but it is just a regular commodity too. It has these possible applications. And so Mises is saying, there is a drawback if you're using an actual commodity as your money, that when there are changes, it's kind of confusing. In a sense, you could say, oh, that is emerging from the commodity side, but what if the commodity is the money? Then it's both at the same time. It's a change originating from the commodity side, but it's also originating from the monetary side, because you're talking about the money commodity. And so it's kind of a neat thing where, Mises is sort of showing you, theoretically, it would be great if you could just have changes originating from the commodity side, but you can't if your money is a commodity. All right, so that's, and then he goes on in that quote to say, but in practice, changes in the supply of and demand for gold and silver in terms of their industrial applications isn't that big a deal historically. And he said, and even if they were much bigger than they were in practice, they still would pale in comparison to what governments can do if they are, have a credit money or fiat money. So the point is, yeah, so Mises is conceding. It's true. It's a disadvantage of our system being a gold standard if a new discovery of gold in California can cause a big inflation. A big increase in the quantity of gold. I don't want to use the word inflation because that's controversial. But that's nothing compared to what the government can do if you have fiat money, because then it's like they've got a possible gold rush, as it were, every minute of the day. It's just their discretion. Do we want to print more or not? Okay, hang on. Let me see how much. All right, let's see how much time we got here. All right, yeah, we're on track. Sorry. Okay, so slide 7. And I'm stressing that this is a reluctant definition. So let me read it to you first, and then I'll explain why this is something that modern Austrians might fight over, and then I'll give you my take on it. All right, so this is coming from page 240. So this is from the appendix to the chapter, or he called it excursus. I don't know if it's called an appendix. All right, so Mises says, in theoretical investigation, there is only one meaning that can rationally be attached to the expression inflation. And that is an increase in the quantity of money in the broader sense of the term, so as to include fiduciary media as well. that is not offset by a corresponding increase in the need for money, again, in the broader sense of the term, so that a fall in the objective exchange value of money must occur. And then he makes a corresponding definition for what deflation means. So in case you're confused, throughout the chapter, he has been referring to inflationism and deflationism. So he said those have strict definitions that are not controversial, whereas this last thing he's pointing out, in case you're wondering, this is how I would define these terms. But so here's, I'm trying to think of the order to tell you this stuff. Okay, so why is this interesting from the perspective of modern Austrian debates? Well, again, there is this big debate, it's called the free banking literature, where guys like Steve Horowitz, George Selgin, Larry White are not opposed to fractional reserve banking per se. They're against central banking, and they're, I think, generally against fiat money. But they say, in principle, why couldn't you have a totally free market where gold or silver is the commodity money, and then banks issue claims giving they're instantly redeemable. There's no doubt about their quality of the ticket. And why couldn't they issue more than they got in the vault? So they only have fractional reserves. There's no fraud involved. That the customers are aware that that's what they're doing. And what's the problem with that? How do we, and they can talk about market forces and what would lead banks to the equilibrium reserve ratio, because you can talk about, if one bank is inflating more than its peers, well, then it's going to lose all of its reserves of the actual commodity money. It's going to go under. So you would have to have an equilibrium that all the banks had roughly the same reserve percentage. There's those factors to weigh off against each other, that obviously other things equal, a given bank wants to inflate more, have a lower reserve ratio because then it can have a bigger loan portfolio. But if it inflates more than its peers, then it's going to lose reserves. So you put those things together, you put them in a big model, and you come up with the equilibrium result. And who's to say that the equilibrium reserve ratio percentage is going to be exactly 100%? Maybe it's going to be 90. Maybe it'll be 84. Maybe it'll be 2. Who knows? So that's where they're coming from. And then guys like Murray Rothbard and Joe Salerno and Guido Hulsman and Hans Hoppe say no. That's and Walter Block say no. That's wrong. Fractional reserve banking per se is fraudulent. And there's arguments they go through with that stuff, saying things like. Because what they don't like in particular is this idea that fiduciary media purports to be an immediately redeemable claim on something that's in the vault, right? So the bank, you go into the bank, you give them your physical coin, 1 ounce gold coin. They give you a bank note that says, Bank XYZ prints this ticket. The holder of this note can turn this in at any Bank XYZ branch, and we'll give you 1 gold ounce coin. No delay. It's upon presentation. And then they also, though, now take that gold coin and lend it to somebody else and sign a, that guy signs a loan contract with them saying, I'm going to borrow this 1 ounce gold coin from you, and then next year I'm going to pay you back 1.1 ounces of gold. And so you can see that, that strikes a lot of people as fraudulent. Like, how can the bank do that? If they wanted to borrow your money and lend it out at a higher interest rate, well, then they could sell you a CD or they could have a savings account. But that's not what they did. You are walking around with this note thinking you can go into a store and spend it. And so their point is it's a contradictory claim that you think you have a perfectly airtight legal claim on that gold coin, but there's a guy walking around town with that coin in his pocket and he thinks he can spend it. And so what's going on there? All right, so that's part of it. But now, so that's like sort of the legal, moral issue. But then there's also just the pure economic issue that you could say, all right, well, forget, suppose they sign contracts with all the customers saying, okay, technically this note, they're going to try to be able to produce the physical gold coin upon demand, but technically they reserve the right to make you wait for that loan to get called and blah, blah, you know, so maybe they can do that kind of stuff. So it's technically not defrauding anybody, but still guys like Salerno and Guido Holzman are going to say, look, fractional reserve banking is inflationary and it is going to cause the boom bust cycle. So whether you think it's immoral per se, it is going to cause boom bust cycle, whereas if you had 100% reserves, no more business cycles. And so that now when you're trying to then you try to figure out, okay, well, what did Mises think? And that's where it gets tricky. So the free bankers like this quote right here that I've just read to you. And they're going to say, see, Mises doesn't say that inflation is any increase in fiduciary media. No, he says inflation only means an increase in fiduciary media that outstrips an increase in the demand to hold money. So in particular, if we've got an original equilibrium and then all of a sudden the community for some reason, you know, maybe because of population growth, maybe just because there's some sort of financial panic and people are worried and they want to just have more liquid assets, whatever reason, if their demand to hold gold suddenly goes up, what's wrong with the banks just lowering their reserve requirements and now, you know, lending more money, and so there's now more tickets floating around that are claims on physical gold, and the public is perfectly happy to have those things in their wallet. And that's good, they say, because it economizes on real resources. Now, for example, if the public for some reason all of a sudden, given the current price of gold, you know, given the gold's purchasing power relative to every other commodity, if for some reason all of a sudden the public wants to hold twice as much gold, if we have 100% reserves, the only way that's going to happen is, first of all, we're going to have to start digging up more gold. And then because everybody now is trying to hoard gold to increase his or her cash balance in physical gold coins or in notes that are perfectly backed up by physical coins in a vault somewhere, you're going to see prices drop. And so that's going to happen until the new equilibrium where the public's desire to hold twice as much gold in real terms is satisfied partly by a physical increase in gold and partly by prices across the board quoted in gold ounces going down, so that, you know, your given number of coins buys you more because prices in general are lower quoted in gold. So the free bankers are going to say that both of those things are bad, that it's wasteful to have to use labor and, you know, gasoline and construction vehicles or whatever to dig up more physical gold. And also, if prices are sticky, it's disruptive to have prices have to fall. And so if we could satisfy the public's desire to hold more gold just by doubling the amount of, you know, just by printing up more notes and having the public hold them, and we know any individual person doesn't care whether he has physical gold coins or notes that in his mind are perfectly substitutable for physical gold coins, then no harm, no foul. Right? So it looks like in this passage that Mises is agreeing with them. And so I've seen Joe Salerno respond to this by just saying, well, okay, Mises wrote this in the beginning of his career. And if you go and look in Human Action, his views have changed by that point. And in fact, by the time he writes Human Action, Mises thinks that the term inflation and deflation, those very terms, don't belong in scientific economics. So that was the way Salerno was handling this issue. He was just saying, okay, yeah, Mises kind of was on your side in that little minor point when he was in his 30s, or I don't remember how old Mises was when he wrote this. But by the time he's mature, he agrees with me. So there you go. And so I was emailing Joe and pointing out that, no, actually, you conceded too much. Even in this thing, look at how he says it just in this quote that I've given you. There is only one meaning that can rationally be attached to the expression. And you, with just seeing this quotation here that I presented, you might think Mises is saying anybody who disagrees with this is irrational. But that's not actually what he means if you look at it in context. What he's saying is, these are very slippery terms, and it's hard to even use them with precision in economic science. So the only way you could use them at all that would be rational would be to do it this way, but I really don't want to. I mean, he didn't say literally I don't want to, but go look at the full quote, the full context, and that's what he's saying. It's almost, I mean, again, I'm exaggerating, but it's almost like he's saying, you stick a gun to my head and make me define inflation and deflation, this is what I would have to say, because anything else I said would be crazy, but these are, this aren't really great terms, all right? And no, the thing that the smoking gun for me is the paragraph before this one that I've quoted here, he says something like, the reader may have noticed that in this book I do not define the terms inflation or deflation. So it's kind of weird to then say, oh, Mises, when he defined those terms, you know, is consistent with the modern free banking, he says, I don't define them. And then he kind of goes on to define them. And so I think, again, what I'm trying to get at is, I think what Mises is saying is, even back at this point, he thinks that these terms are not well suited to be used, like the way fiduciary media for him is a very legitimate, perfectly precise scientific term for use in economic science, where he thinks inflation and deflation are not such terms. So anyway, I spent too much time on that. Notice, by the way, me having said all that, I'm not saying therefore the free bankers are wrong and the 100% reserve guys are right. All I'm saying is, on the issue of into which camp did Mises fall, one of the major points of the free bankers, I think, actually isn't as strong as they believe. That for me was always a really strong arrow that they had, and it's upon closer inspection, Mises is not giving a full-throated defense of those definitions. Okay, last thing, we got 8 minutes here. So let me try to knock this one out quickly, and then I'll see if I can answer one of your questions. So slide number eight, monetary policy and foreign trade. Mises says on page 250, rates of exchange vary because the quantity of money varies and the prices of commodities vary. The balance of payments theory forgets that the volume of foreign trade is completely dependent upon prices, that neither exportation nor importation can occur if there are no differences in prices to make trade profitable. All right, so what he's getting at here is there is a certain theory saying, for example, in certain cases, it wouldn't work to have a strong currency. Like if there's a country that's suffering from a trade deficit, for example, the last thing in the world that country wants to do is to engage in a strong currency policy. Because if you're suffering from a trade deficit where your people are buying more stuff from abroad than foreigners are buying of your exports, then the way to fix that is to depreciate your currency. You want to make your currency weaken against foreign currencies so that foreign goods are now more expensive to your people because your currency now trades for fewer units of their currency. And vice versa, you want your goods to now be more to be cheaper for foreigners to buy. And the way to do that is to depreciate your currency. So, Mises, what he's getting at here is no, that's a very superficial view. That when it comes to like a foreigner, like let's say a foreign miller who's trying to set up, okay, I want to buy wheat from somewhere to turn it into flour. And so let's say it's a guy in France. He says, okay, I could buy it from somewhere in the European Union. So what's the wheat price, or sorry, what's the euro price of wheat from people, you know, in my currency region or block? And that's whatever it is. Or I could buy it from the farmer in the United States who's, you know, selling wheat. And so then what's the price there? So there's two calculations he's got to do. So yes, it is relevant to see what is the euro-US dollar exchange ratio, but that's also relevant to know what's the spot price of wheat measured in dollars versus wheat measured in euros. You see, so it's not merely a question of the dollar-euro exchange rate. It's also a matter of the euro bushel of wheat exchange rate and the dollar bushel of wheat exchange rate, if you will. And so that's, so they're only going to import, the miller's only going to import American wheat instead of using wheat from some, you know, immediately neighboring country if those two things both line up together to make the American wheat cheaper, accounting for the, you know, shipping costs and all that stuff. So that's a very simple point Mises is getting at here. And he goes on to say, you know, there's no, a country does not need to worry about having a strong currency policy because of international trade issues. That your domestic prices will adjust so that you can get whatever the desired, you know, whatever the so-called natural exports and imports would be. It's not like that's going to tie your hands and make you therefore have to have a weak currency. No, just do what you're going to do. Tie your currency to gold, Mises would say, and then your domestic prices will adjust. If you're running a trade, you know, an unfavorable trade balance, meaning you're buying more stuff than you're selling, and you have that strong thing, well, then what's going to happen? Eventually, your people are going to start running out of money, and then they're going to be able to buy less, and then so they're going to spend less, and then prices domestically will go down. So your currency will be still locked into the same exchange ratio with other currencies, but things will get cheaper in your country, and then that will make foreigners now start buying stuff from your producers. I had a response to, what's his name, Dean Baker on that issue. I can't remember the name of the Mises.org article, but in my archives, I walked through that if that sort of thing interests you. So I guess if you Google Robert Murphy, Dean Baker, Mises trade or something, you'd probably find it. But I just walked through that, the point that Mises is making there. Okay, we got time for one question. Let me pull it up. And then, so next week, 7, we start getting into banking. So that's the real fun stuff. Thus far, we've been mostly focusing on money. Okay, it was one kind of long one and then a short one. So in the interest of time, let me just deal with the short one and I'll answer the longer one in the forum itself. So Dennis Foster says, you quoted Mises on slide 4. In all countries where inflation has been rapid, it has been observed that the decrease in the value of the money has occurred faster than the increase in its quantity, end quote. So now this is Dennis Foster talking. And you have noted that the monetary base of the U.S. has grown dramatically over the last few years, yet we haven't seen an appreciable erosion of value. Is it just a timing issue? Okay, well, first of all, let me just be pedantic. Those two things that you noted there aren't in conflict. All right, so Mises is not saying in all countries where the quantity of money has increased, you've seen a rapid fall in the value of the money. Which then, you know, if Mises had said that, and then we said, wait a minute, but in the U.S., that apparently didn't happen, what's going on? No, well, all Mises is saying here is, if you look at countries where the value of their money has dropped quickly in a short period of time by a large amount, and then you say, okay, so now we're just looking at those countries where there has been a rapid fall in the value of the money, then you inquire further and say, okay, what were the authorities doing with the, you know, their maintenance or their decisions regarding the quantity of that money? Mises says, in every case, you will see that by the end of that process, when the money was really losing its value very quickly, they were inflating in terms of increasing the quantity, but not as much as the value is falling. So Mises' point is once that those expectations take hold and people start thinking that the money's going to lose value, it's sort of like letting the genie out of the bottle. That it starts happening fast, it snowballs, it happens faster than just the mechanical proportional increase in the quantity would lead you to expect. Okay, to answer your question, there's a few things. So yes, the monetary base has gone up quite significantly in the last 3.5 years. One way I like to tell people is that Ben Bernanke has created more U.S. dollars than all previous Fed chairmen combined. So then why isn't gasoline $20 a gallon? Well, there's a couple things. One is those reserves are largely bottled up in the banks. Now, to be clear, I don't like when people make it sound like it's not real money. Like sometimes people make it sound like, that's not really money yet because it hasn't been lent out. And well, no, I mean, what the Fed creates is more money than what your local commercial bank creates, legally speaking. The Fed is, a bank's reserves with the Fed legally is money just as much as a $100 bill, whereas your demand deposit with Citibank in your checking account is not nearly as solid. Like if the bank went down and FDIC ran out of money, technically what you have there is not as airtight as if you had literally a $100 bill in your wallet, or as a commercial bank having literally reserves on deposit with the Fed. So don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying Bernanke's not really creating money the way some people kind of imply, but it is relevant, I think, that when we're wondering how come we haven't seen the prices of bread and milk and eggs and gasoline rise more quickly than they have been rising, we should mention, but how come they're not through the roof? Well, it's because Citibank is buying treasuries. It's not going out and buying gallons of gasoline. And the general public, the people that you would think would be the ones that would fuel an across-the-board increase in just the prices of all goods and services, they actually don't have that extra trillion-plus dollars Bernanke created in their possession. So I think that's part of it. I mean, just forget all this crazy stuff about monetary base. I mean, if there was just a king who was printing up notes with his picture on them, and he printed up a bunch and handed it out to 10 nobles, and they literally just took those notes and put them in their vaults and locked them up, that would only affect prices to the extent that the community was vaguely aware of what happened and then, change their own expectations and, reduce their demand to hold the currency because they knew there was this extra stockpile that at any moment might get dumped into circulation, as it were. And even that term circulation I don't quite like. Right? So that's part of what's going on. And then the other thing is the demand to hold dollars has gone way up since the financial crisis set in. The people are panicked. They're rushing to perceived safety and liquidity. And so what do you want to hold? Well, first of all, dollar-denominated assets as opposed to euro-denominated ones or some other currency, and in particular, cash. And so, I think that's partly when you see the big spike in things like M1, it's partly because various people in the economy, when they're looking at their overall portfolio, like the composition of their wealth, they want to have a lot more of it in FDIC guaranteed bank deposits, as opposed to having them in corporate bonds or having them in soybean futures or some whatever real estate projects, crazy derivatives that some hedge fund made up, they want to concentrate more of it. So if everybody in the community is doing that to some degree, then that can lead to the new equilibrium, a much higher quantity of money, even if we're talking about M1, without the consumer price index being much higher. So I think that's another part of what's going on there. Okay, well, we are over time. Right, because we started it, ever since I messed it up that one night, I'm gun shy. Okay, So I will get your guys' quiz posted, send you an email on that, and I will schedule the office hours for this weekend. And we are now in the home stretch here. So this is where, if you've been hanging on and keeping up with the reading, I encourage you to just keep with it, that we're now getting into the banking stuff. And so it's, you know, the next week's lecture, we're going to just set up the rudiments of the Misesian system for banking, you know, his various classification systems and how he understand it. And then finally, in the last lecture, we'll get to the, you know, what we've been working for, the Misesian explanation of the trade cycle.